I'm Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing a wide range of research projects in which our academics are currently involved. With me today is Professor Anthony Bonanno, Head of the Department of Classics and Archaeology here at the University. Welcome, Professor. Today, however, he's going to talk about an EU project entitled CASA, and I shall leave it to Professor Bonanno to explain what CASA stands for, the usual acronym.
I must say it's a very strange acronym, and originally when it was proposed to us, we weren't too optimistic that it would succeed, but fortunately it went through the bureaucratic processes and approved.
So tell us what it stands for.
The acronym stands for Koine Archaeologica Sapiente Antichità. Koine, of course, is a common language or a common cultural trait, in this case limited to archaeology, and then archaeology is also combined to antiquity. Which I see with antiquity, we meant from the very beginning, prehistory down to even early modern times. And sapiente antichità, that referring to antiquity, but wise antiquity, that is full of wisdom.
I think that it's true that perhaps it was a bit of a complicated title, but it showed a bit of imagination on the part of the people who are examining your project, that they could see that underneath the title there was an interesting project lurking.
Yes, that's right. Yes, the objectives were to, first of all, it was geographically limited to Malta relationship with southeastern Sicily. By southeastern Sicily, we meant, or it was meant to include Syracuse, that is, province of Syracuse and the province of Ragusa, which show the closest relationship and common elements with Malta. But the project leader was Catania University, because there isn't a university in either Ragusa or in Syracuse. But they roped in also, strange enough, Palermo, which is on the more remote western corner. But apparently the Interreg 3A program, of which this made form part, allowed for that inclusion as well. The objectives were to identify, as I said, the common, in this case, archaeological as well as cultural heritage elements between the two areas, and the to identify, the second objective was to identify possibilities of combined tourist itineraries. The first step would be to establish these elements, these common elements, and then to develop them into or highlighting them in the formation and the creation of itineraries that would combine both southeastern Sicily and Malta, and to encourage cross currents, cross current in cultural tourism.
And certainly that makes sense. I mean, it makes logical sense. It makes archaeological sense. We're so near, really, much nearer than people sometimes imagine, that it would, touristically speaking, it would be actually quite easy to organize this kind of
exchange. Yes, even from the academic point of view, professional and university-wise point of view, I've always found this anomaly where we still have so close relationship with Britain, for example, even as a university, and with Sicily so little contact. I'm sure that over the last 20, 30 years it has improved, but not sufficiently.
Was the contact made actually because they knew you personally, or from the University of Catania? Was it a sort of networking approach, or did they just decide to ask you?
We as a department were known to our Sicilian colleagues. In fact, the one of the project leaders did call Malta in the middle of summer, I think, if I remember well, it was in August, And yes, they approached us and we said, okay, we're ready. And I made it clear from the very start that I am an academic and I want to limit my role to the scientific one. But eventually things developed otherwise. For a number of reasons, I had also to face the bureaucratic setup, which was not easy because we were the first to embark on this type of project in this program, the Interreg 3A. Now, it's a difficult role, really, because one embarks on aspects like finances, budgeting, and so on, with which one is not normally familiar. Fortunately, I had some support from the administration of the university itself and from, certainly from within the department. We have a laboratory officer who is not supposed to go into these, and fortunately he was willing to learn how to do things and how to go, and he did it very properly, very appropriately.
That is really the key, that you learn the procedures, because at first it looks really daunting, but then once you get into the mindset of the people who are actually setting the agenda vis-a-vis the creation of the project or the way in which it has to be presented, then of course it makes things easier. And the people who've actually managed to understand the ways of these projects are actually worth their weight in gold, really.
And we learned that our Sicilian neighbors are a little bit more creative and intelligent in facing such bureaucracies.
One of the things that struck me about this particular project when I was reading up, in preparation for this interview, was that it seemed very wide-ranging. It didn't focus on one particular small period. How did you manage as partners to cope with that? Did you say, listen, you know, we can do so much and, you know, somebody else will have to do the other bits? How did you break it up into bite-sized chunks?
Yes, you are right. It was a question of knowing the resources. In this case, of course, human resources, academic resources. I can judge only from my part, from the Maltese side. We had work packages with so much money assigned, specifically also broken down, you know, 1,000 euros or 3,000 euros to this particular. And fortunately, with some brainstorming and the help of Dr. Nicholas Vella, we identified the potential researchers to undertake different research projects. And they ranged, as you have suggested, from prehistory, for example, a database of lytic instruments, of stone instruments, flint, chert, and so on, which Clive Vella did, a present master's candidate, to the Tonnara of Melliha, again by a former student of ours, a group of students, former students of ours, who form a cooperative, to a medieval cave, the San Leonardo cave by Keith Buhajar, who is now even a PhD candidate, and a short database of maps showing Malta and its relations to Sicily, as well as another one on the ex-votos, again, which showed this close interrelationship between Sicily and southeastern Sicily and Malta.
Well, all very interesting subjects. Before delving a little bit more into the subjects themselves, I'd just like to remind listeners that this is Research Matters. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I'm speaking today to Professor Anthony Bonanno. You mentioned several interesting subjects. Perhaps we could go into the actual content of the research a little bit further. You mentioned lytic instruments. Where did those come from? What was discussed in that presentation?
Right. We identified two sites from which a body of such flint tools or instruments came, namely the Scorba site, which one would have expected had been properly investigated and studied. They were not. And the lytic instruments that came from our own excavation at Tassilge. And Clive Bella was already working on these for his masters, and we commissioned a specific task for this purpose. And then what else? Yes, again, the San Leonardo cave was chosen as a topic by Keith Bahajar himself, who has been writing and now is also lecturing on medieval archaeology in Malta.
Where would the connection have come with Sicily, for example, in that area? Would there have been some research into similar areas going on at the same time in Sicily, and then there might have been some compare and contrast work going on, some comparative research?
Certainly, yes. Similar parallel research is taking place in Sicily, in particular on flints. And Clive Vella was very much aware of this, and in fact he actually conducted an excursion to Sicily in search of the sources of some of the flint which was imported in Malta. Everybody knows that Malta does not have any flint in its geological formation, and that in prehistoric times a lot of flint was imported together with obsidian, but obsidian is the sources of obsidian are outside this geographical area. And in another activity which we organized, namely a study tour for our students, for our postgraduate students, of the more difficult to reach, the less accessible sites, archaeological sites of southern Sicily, was very revealing. And in fact, for example, Clive, we together, during a visit to a museum, learned that there were many other types of flint available in southeastern Sicily than previously aware of.
Fruitful from that point of view.
Yes, yes. And even another example, Keith Bahajar, during that excursion, discovered at least one, if not more, water channels of the Fogara or Anat type, which farmers exploit in order to irrigate their fields inside valleys, of which we have many examples in Malta, and that was that is currently the subject also of his research.
The Tonnara idea, is that something that has been researched before in Malta, the idea that there was a Tonnara?
I think this is the first time that an investigation, historical as well as archaeological investigation, was conducted. The specific Tonnara that was investigated and surveyed, the Tonnara at Meliha, was really a military redoubt, which was converted. I think it has also a British period or early British period building on top of it, which has been turned into a museum of the Tonnara. But there were several other Tonnara distributed around Malta, and a certain Muscat joined forces with Ernest Vella and Marlene Gaglia, and he wrote the historical background of this. As I said, I don't know of any other serious studies, or at least published studies, of the Tonnara before this.
Because we associate Tonnara, obviously, with Sicily so much.
Sicily, no, but,
and don't imagine that we had our own version.
There was one, in fact, even in St. Julian's, very close to Ar Harc Hamim, near Villa Rosa. I found this by chance when I was looking at a diagram of that particular cave, and on the left top side there is a small building and a label, a caption saying "It Tonnara." Yes, so there must have been more. If we look for more, I'm sure that we'll find more.
Would this kind of fishing for wild, Tani obviously, would have been up to recent times?
Up to recent times. In Sicily they are more fortunate than ours. They still have the original setups, that is Tonnara setups, with very wide spaces for processing of the tuna itself.
It's interesting that you mentioned before about the lithic instruments, the fact that there's still so much that needs to be investigated, because obviously Scoroba, as you say, was an excavation that was excavated thoroughly. We know a lot about it. And yet the material that came up from the excavation still can be useful in the discovery of new elements to do with that period.
Yeah, this is part of my declared policy as head of department of the Department of Classics and Archaeology, that is to render us, ourselves, as self-sufficient as possible. You can never be totally self-sufficient. There's always room for collaboration with foreigners, and you've got always a lot to learn. But we need someone who is expert on our own pottery. I don't think we have to depend always on foreign expertise. And the same applies for lithic instruments. I think we needed a local person to be able to come up with a report on the lithic, on this specialized material, lithic instruments.
Something about southeast Sicily. Perhaps you could tell us a little about the ground in southeast Sicily. What does it look like? What kind of archaeological areas are there in southeast Sicily?
Geologically and topographically, southeast Sicily is very close, very similar to Malta. It is limestone. Remember, we're here south of Etna. Etna provides a boundary where, after which then volcanic rock occurs. And you'd be surprised how many common elements there are. There is a common prehistory, of course. Our first colonizers or settlers in Malta came from southeast Sicily. They carried the culture here, and they set it up, and from then on, obviously, the Maltese prehistoric inhabitants developed their own culture, which is very strange, very strangely and unexpectedly does not appear at all in Sicily. This is a subject that needs a deeper analysis, I think. But apart from the temple culture, which, as I said, is a characteristic only of Malta and nowhere else, not even in southeast Sicily, the rest is, there's a lot of interrelationship between the two. Even down to medieval times, even in the catacombs, for example. But even there, in the catacombs, you know more than I do, that one particular element, the so-called mensa or triclinium, does not occur in Sicily at all.
It is very strange how we get these isolated cultural manifestations that compare and
right,
contrast. Because even though in antiquity the 69 miles or whatever, the distance was obviously sort of greater in the sense that it was more dangerous,
today,
more difficult.
Yeah,
but on the other hand, Sicily at that time, Malta, would have been visible from Sicily.
Precise.
It still is a little bit today, but obviously our view has been obscured by the refineries in southeastern Sicily.
Only occasionally
you get bright lights of the closest port are seen. But in antiquity, probably it was actually much clearer. You could probably much clearer than you ever could today. So the connection was there, and yet there seems to be this strange fact that some things are very similar and some things are completely
different.
In front of us, there is this lovely collection of books, which is in fact only part of what has actually been created through the CASA project. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the publications, because at the end of the day, the projects go through, people meet up, you have your conferences, everyone goes home at the end of the day. And what can really remain for students to consult, for academics to consult, is the actual, the famous deliverable, the publication, or the CD or DVD this case.
All of them, yes.
Tell us a little bit about these publications.
Yes, it's a source of great satisfaction to see at the end of a project 9 volumes, printed volumes, as well as the CD and a DVD, on which I shall explain later on. Yes, 9 volumes with a very wide range of topics. I limit myself to a select few. Volume 1, for example, is the collection of the proceedings of the papers delivered in two different seminars, one held in Malta and the other held in Catania, with a specific theme. Namely, in Italian it sounds much better than in English, Malta negli iblei, gli iblei a Malta. That is, again, the connections, interrelationships between Malta and this area of Sicily, southeastern Sicily, which is dominated by the Iblean mountains, the Monti Iblei. We have mentioned Flint, for example. That's one source. But there was a lot of exchange both ways, in even prehistoric times, between this area and Malta. Suffice it to say that in the Bronze Age, for example, we were the producers, if you like, and Sicily was on the receiving end. The Borgia-Nadur culture, for example, is much more apparent in southeastern Sicily and Ionia. They have whole vases, a range of whole vases from just one site, Cozzo del Pantano, for example, in the Museum of Syracuse, more than we have ourselves.
Magnificent museum.
Yes, yes, exactly. Then, specifically, in fact, on the Bronze Age, I have selected a thinner publication written by an allievo, a student of the project leader, Professor Militello, namely Davide Tanasi, who wrote a very deep investigation, I think it's, again, it's a first, about Sicilia, Sicily and the Maltese archipelago in the Bronze Age. So he did also study the material in the museum, National Museum of Archaeology, thanks to the cooperation of Heritage Malta, and he even, I remember, discovered one particular shard which seemed to have escaped the attention of previous investigators, and if it's not a Mycenaean fragment, it's probably close to it or inspired by it.
Why would that be an important discovery?
Yes, because it had not been identified before.
And the connection with the Mycenaean period would be interesting.
This is about, in fact, I said Sicily and Maltese archipelago. There's a third component which appears in the later on. That is the Aegean. That is the connection of these two areas with the Aegean, namely Greece, which was the late Bronze Age, or middle Bronze Age, Mycenaean.
This is always a much discussed area in Maltese Bronze Age culture. You know, how much connection was there from,
from the Aegean? Connections increased, even cultural connections. There's a lot of exchange, cultural exchange, in contrast with the period immediately before, that is the Temple period. Right, then to focus on the Sicilian contribution, there is one volume on the archaeological landscapes of southeastern Sicily. As I said, focused on that area, but one goes into it, one can also discover, identify the common elements with Malta's, I mean, with Malta's archaeological landscape, such as the catacombs, in fact, right? Finally, we should not forget that this project contributed physically to the exploration of a new site, namely a thorough 3D, three-dimensional survey of the hypogeal, that is, underground complex of tombs and catacombs under the Wynyacourt Museum in Rabat. This was an opportunity for funds, because state-of-the-art instruments were used for this, and we're thankful for our Sicilian to our Sicilian counterparts for this idea, for this contribution. And I'm sure that Monsignor Don Juan Azzopardi is equally grateful for this, and he's very happy that this was conducted, and it ended up also in a volume,
as well as the
CD. Then, as I said, there is the CD, which unfortunately a limited number of copies of these volumes, about 300, so we don't have many that many copies to distribute, but the all the content of all the volumes can be accessed on the website of CASA, as well as on a CD. And if there is anyone of which we have sufficient stock, if anyone is interested, he can contact me or our secretary on, I think if I mention the number, 2340-2046, and ask for Candida Gerada, who will provide a copy. And then finally, we also produced a DVD which contains all the projects, specific projects, research projects that I mentioned earlier on, about seven of them, and two very interesting interactive programs, one by David Mallia and his team, giving the itineraries, followed by three grand tour visitors to Malta, namely Howell, Badger, and another one, where one can actually trace these itineraries, highlight each spot, see the text, and also illustrations. And another one, another project by Vincent Zamit and David Pace on an itinerary, tourist itinerary, but cultural tourism itinerary, of Rabat and the area, archaeological landscape, if you like, between Rabat and Meliha.
Well, that's absolutely wonderful. It really was a great project, and it's really lovely to see these publications, and I'd like to thank you very much, Professor Bonanno, for coming to talk to us about
Thank you for your invitation.
If you would like further details about the University of Malta's research projects or any other information, please access our website at www.um.edu.mt. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.